Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Today's podcast takes you to the last Mumbrella question time, where we ask the questions: do awards really matter? Which agencies lead social media? The secrets of winning new business? And what do you think of recruitment agencies? Thanks. In case you weren't here earlier, I'm Tim from Mumbrella. Thank you very much for joining us. Let me introduce the panel to you. On my far left, James Greet, I'm not sure if I can still call him newly anymore, but recent. He's finished his. He's passed his probation. He hasn't passed his probation. So we'll have to see how it goes today. CEO of media agency Mindshare. Most recently before that, James ran the media side of recruitment agency The Ladder. And before that, he also ran media agency OMD. Next along, Stuart Greger. He's the owner and founder of specialist lifestyle PR agency Liquid Ideas. He's very fortunate because he really only seems to work with brands that look like they're a lot of fun. Stuart started his career as a journalist. On my other side, Simone Drury is the managing director of DDB Group's experiential and public relations arm, Mango, which I seem to remember when they rebranded, they described themselves as DDB's hot little sister. Well, I quoted you as that. Simone was also this year's Australian representative on the public relations jury at the Cannes Lions. And then next along, Andy Ridley, another man who was who's been to Cannes. Andy is co-founder of Earth Hour. Prior to developing Earth Hour with Leo Burnett and Fairfax, he was communications director for WWF Australia and has previously worked with the likes of the Prince's Trust in London and Action Against Hunger. So we now go to questions. First question comes from Mark Holden of PhD, if you can make yourself known, and we'll get a microphone to you.
Good morning.
Don't bother to finish your breakfast before speaking.
There'll be bits of bread on the microphone, just so everyone knows. My question is about social media, and I'd love to hear the panel argue as to which agency is best placed to lead social media. Now, clearly all agencies can be involved in it, but who's the best agency to lead and why? That's my question.
Let's maybe start with Stuart for that one.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping you weren't going to say, Tim. probably not us is my first answer. I think we're a good support. I think you need to find the people who have the greatest degree of expertise. So you've got to ask all the right questions, to be perfectly honest. First of all, not the client. That's obvious. Second of all, I think someone... there's some great specialist agencies around in social media. It's much more complicated. We now have a sort of a dedicated person doing some social media stuff, but we're a long way short of some of those really good agencies. So... my only advice to anyone who is looking to appoint someone is to really, really push them hard on what they know and how good they are, because there's a fair bit of bullshit going around about it as well, to be honest. So maybe Mindshare.
Well, we'll come to Mindshare in a moment. firstly,
I think a media agency is the only one that you sort of didn't discount, wasn't it?
Well, firstly, we'll take the other PR perspective. We'll see whether Simone agrees that PR shouldn't lead the social media charge.
I'm from a little bit of a different model to Stuart, and we basically have whoever is the right person to work on it. So in some instances, it might be a combination of someone with a PR background mixed with somebody with a really strong digital background. So for us, it might be a Mango person with a tribal person with an above-the-line person that brings it all together. And then currently we're doing some work with one client where we've got the CRM person and the digital and the PR person on the team. So it really depends on the client. I don't think that traditional PR agencies will lead really from the front on social media. And we can see that media agencies are quite often pipping us at the post for some things. So it's really about who's got the best expertise rather than which discipline of agency, in my opinion.
I wasn't discounting the entire industry, just my company. Just want to make that... Just want to make that clear. There's some very good social media people in PR. And it does have, if you're interacting with customers and you're talking, you know, you're interacting with media, it's important that you take a PR approach to it. I just think you need to have, and by that I mean an engagement approach, not the lectoring, hectoring sort of approach. But yeah, mango sound pretty good.
James Greed.
Well, as it's clearly a hot potato, I suppose someone's got to pick it up at some stage. I think our viewpoint on that question mark is quite simple, and I think there's two bits to it. I guess the first bit is actually who's best positioned to identify the role of social media along with any other sort of influential channel. And I think as a business, we very much see that as part of our role, which is how do we best actually build an insight into our audience and identify which range of channels are the most appropriate to use, and then how do we bind them together and use them. Now, we obviously have individuals within our business that are very, very sort of understanding and very insightful into the space, the emergent space of social media. What we've tried to do as well is ensure, most importantly, the guys who take the strategy role and the insight leadership role within our company understand its role and its potential and its influence. So we're able to actually sort of put together, I guess, a vision for how our brand's going to use media and the role of social media within that where appropriate. And there's some terrific work that we've just done recently where the campaign begins and ends with social media. In terms of actually having the resource on board to then execute and make it happen, look, I guess as it's a relatively emergent space for us, we wouldn't necessarily say that every campaign we work on when there's a role for social media, we would actually execute it. I think one of the interesting things about, I guess, the emergent sort of digital landscape and how technology is influencing it is if you actually look at the model that companies like News are taking, they recognise that they can't necessarily do everything. So it's about finding the right affiliations and the right partnerships. So to that end, I've actually got a meeting afterwards with Wonderman, because in London we've actually worked with them on a joint project to actually look at how we really sort of take leadership in this space without having to duplicate and replicate resources. And that would sort of make sense for us here in Australia. It's a relatively small market, so in something that's relatively new, we'd probably sort of look at a partnership to incubate it. And then once it actually got up and running, there was enough business behind it, then we might look at executing ourselves.
And the partnership in this case is with another WPP company. Would you see that as being the model for you?
Well, potentially. Look, at the end of the day, I think, you know, we're in a client-focused industry, so it's whatever works best with clients. Because usually, if it works well for clients, then there's revenue and there's a business opportunity for us.
Now, in a moment, we will go to Andy, but someone is desperate to come in on this point.
No, I just wanted to ask James a question. How do you work when you've got a global brand? We're quite fortunate in some of the work we've done has been with sort of Telstra, Tourism Australia. So very simple to execute social media in this market because the brand is geographically fits this market. But you're working with some bigger global brands. How have you approached that from a social media strategy perspective?
Well, I suppose it depends whether you're talking about campaigns that are originated from this market and focus on this market, which virtually everything we do is focused purely on Australia. So we're not actually influencing anything that originates from overseas.
Now, just before we take Andy's point, is Lorraine Djokovic from Loud here? I heard a yes from somewhere. Can we get the microphone to Lorraine? Because it's a question aimed at Andy, and I think we can probably wrap both in together.
Thank you. It's very much a similar question to Mr. Holden. Thank you. But I was very interested, given social media seems to be increasingly important to the outcomes of your campaign, which agency for you is best placed to introduce and manage the social media requirements?
Yeah, I think probably the last two points. The one about it's a global campaign, so you're working in in the case of Earth Hour, 38 different languages, 128 different countries, varying levels of technology and varying levels of insight and how it works in each country. So the first thing is there is no one answer to the question. And I guess the second part is that for Earth Hour, it's a very low budget operation. So it's really how can you get something to happen? It may not be your ideal path necessarily, but it is a case of trial and error. And we do make quite a lot of errors. Every now and again something amazing happens and then we can share that around the Earth Hour campaign and people will copy it. So there is no one answer, but I would say that traditional, so from a billboard to, a magazine ad, is still important in terms of our social media, because it's about empowering people to take part and to make them feel that the campaign is theirs as well as, being run from a central point. It needs to be really an open source campaign. So we use traditional to empower people to use social media.
Now, still on the subject of moving away from traditional advertising, Fergus Stoddart from Edge Custom Media.
Similar area. In a world increasingly influenced by search and social media, we hear of content becoming more and more critical with customers, yet Australia seems to be lagging behind the rest of the world when it comes to reducing their spend on traditional media and moving across to content-led campaigns. Your comments, please.
Stuart, content more important?
Yes, of course it is, because that's, I think, where we can, we as an industry, with a background, I think, excuse me, if I look at our business, we've got 3 or 4 ex-journalists in various areas of lifestyle within our business, and I think content is increasingly king, and what we're finding is with more and more of our clients, we're finding a larger traditional, so we work with some of the big beer brands, for instance, we work with all of the bigger premium Foster's brands. We're finding that the budgets are slowly going from sort of 95% headed up into old-fashioned traditional advertising, big ads, if you like, for want of an immediate campaign right now. And more of it's heading towards this content of how do we engage people better, how do we write more stories, and I think that's where businesses like ours come in king. I think content is going to be king, whether it's production of, content-driven, all that sort of stuff. But are we a little bit further behind than some of the other markets? Yeah, I think we are. But also some of the other markets have made some of the mistakes before we're going to make those mistakes. Certainly a couple of guys I know in LA have made a few mistakes on producing content-branded TV. I'd like to also thank you, Tim, for making me the little token Aussie on the panel. Thank you.
Well, we had to have one Australian accent. I did have a moment of horror where I thought there actually wouldn't be one at all. And then I looked at it and thought, oh, yeah, Stuart's all there. It's all right. James Greet.
Sort of moving on, because you wanted a global perspective, didn't you? So that's why I invited people.
Yeah, the world centres on London.
Look, I think
1600s.
Shut up. I think sometimes the whole point of being a second mover is smarter, because then you actually get to sort of learn from someone else's mistakes. Actually, whether or not we are behind now or not, I don't know. I don't think we are so much. I know we sometimes like to sort of bemoan the fact that Australia is a little bit slower than the rest of the world and clients here are conservative. I don't think that's necessarily the case, because I think in some cases they do actually have a reason for being a little bit sort of reluctant to move. I mean, I've spoken to quite a few FMCG-based clients recently, and if you ask them kind of what their biggest fear is or what keeps them up at night, the competition comes about 4 or 5 in terms of ranking. Their retail partners is 1, 2, and 3, if you like. And I think that probably is the biggest sort of reluctant influence on the slowness to change. I think a lot of small clients are moving ahead quite nicely and recognise that they actually need to sort of behave as a content player. They need to have a relevant experience to get people to come to them, because it's very easy to edit brands out of your life and edit their advertising commercial messages out of your life now. And I think, the bigger ones are probably slightly slower to change, because they have more to lose. They have more to risk. Their model works them at the moment. There are other players influencing why they can and can't do stuff. But I don't think we are actually that slow. I think there's some really interesting stuff that's happening. I mean, having had 2 or 3 years out of the industry and having worked on content programs over the last 10 years in London and China, I think the only reason sort of brands were slow to sort of engage with it was because they didn't necessarily see how it was actually driving their business. So I think over a period of time, people are beginning to realise and understand the relationship between content and the influence it's actually having on selling stuff, okay, which is the most important thing. And I think as we get access to more and more data and we learn how to use that, then it's becoming easier to understand, I guess, the influence of a content-based model on actually selling stuff. And there's some stuff that I've been exposed to at Mindshare over the last 2 or 3 months, and they are case studies that have done very, very well in the MFAs, and they are all content-based propositions. So there are some good examples out there.
the question there was to ask him to name an example.
Yeah, thank you. Well, one of the examples that I've seen, and one of the guys who was involved in it, is some work that we've done with Land Rover, where we basically had to try and sort of sell Land Rover Defenders to an audience other than farmers, simply because farmers had bought them over the last 20 years and they hadn't broken because they were so good. So trying to find someone to buy 90 new Defenders was the challenge. The idea was to focus on an urban audience, one that actually sort of really valued the opportunity to go off-road, hence a focus on kids that loved finding those hard-to-reach surf breaks. And so the concept of, rather than just advertising to these guys, but actually sort of build a content-based idea, which was broadcast online, of the world's greatest surf trip, was born. And that was something that basically sort of began and finished with social media, and at its heart was a content-based idea. And at the end of the campaign had created a lot of publicity, a lot of interest, and sold 90 Defenders. Now, I mean, it's a relatively small example, but trying to sell shift metal is quite hard. And this is a conversation I was having with Ford the other day. On average, they might have 3,000 units of one particular model to sell. Yet, traditionally, what we do is we'll go and spend $4 or $5 million on advertising and expose that via advertising to 5 million Australians. 5 million people get to see advertising to buy 3,000 cars. Now, I think where we want to move to is obviously getting greater access to data and human insight. So actually, we know the 15,000 people that are going to be in the market that year to buy a car of that model, and then somehow build an experience that engages them with Ford, rather than lots of advertising on TV to lots of people that have no interest in buying a car like that this year. And then a user experience, which is the showroom, which is the most kind of horrible, outdated user experience that you've ever found. So, you know, we've got a really interesting model with the Defender, how we actually then expand that to models that want to sell 3,000 is our challenge next.
Let's move to Andy next.
Run the question past me again.
Content.
Content is king. I suppose with Earth Hour, we live off content. We need decent content. And going back to the first question around how do we gather content, that's the biggest challenge for us. So, you know, how do we actually stimulate people to start the conversation? And how do we make sure how do we try and get some of that conversation not to just be, quirky? Quirky's good, but quirky can't be everything. And I think the fundamental challenge for Earth Hour is taking Earth Hour beyond the hour. And the fundamental way that we would do that is stimulating conversation and hearing what people are doing beyond the hour. Yeah, that's a really big challenge for us, and I don't think we have the answers to it yet, but we're working really hard to try and find a way through. And I'll just say, there are some places where it is happening, and we've found some really bizarre things. Earth Hour obviously started in Australia, and it's climate change orientated. What we found in other countries, so in China, it's become about air pollution. In South Africa, there was a big emphasis on water pollution. In Brazil, it was about the Amazon. So it's gone beyond climate. It's Earth Hour, not climate hour. But the question for us again is, how do we get these stories to come to us? And I reckon we hear about 0.1% of these stories at the moment, and we'd love to hear 10%, because it would stimulate the campaign even more.
Simone.
I agree with everything that James said, absolutely, and I think Mindshare and the work they've done with Unilever in the States on branded content has been incredible. But one of the things I've found that is fortunate for Australia is because we are a small market, and the way that we are geographically placed, is that traditional advertising in some cases does still work that doesn't work in other countries. So it's kind of like if you're a Coles or you're a Woolworths or you're a McDonald's, traditional routes are still very valid. And I'm not in favour of trying to get everybody to rush out and create content-based campaigns. We've just done some really interesting work with Telstra, with their youth demographic, which is content-based, but they're very notoriously hard to reach. So I think Australia is in a fortunate position where we can go out with some of these ideas, but
what,
still...
What was the Telstra?
The Telstra, basically sort of the last 12 months, we've been really working on a sort of digitally-led, content-led, with sort of experiential and PR-driven campaign rather than above the line for the youth audience with Telstra, because they just weren't being reached, and obviously they've got different perceptions of that brand. So a good example with a demographic that's hard to reach and content savvy,
Was that a single campaign or a series?
No, it's an ongoing campaign, yeah.
Are you allowed to talk about what it was? Are you dodging the subject?
No, I'm not dodging the subject. It started with last summer with Cabioki, where we had an experiential event around the city with karaoke in cabs that then could be filmed to go up on YouTube. They could vote, pass it on to their friends. It went on and on with the PR element. There was consumer promotions in there. There was a retail promotion in there. Then it sort of just moved throughout the year.
Okay, well, let's get another English accent. James Welsh from Oddfellows for the next question.
I believe there are only four clear steps a business needs to win new customers. So since we're among friends and I represent a creative agency that therefore don't compete with any of you, I'd love to know your secrets.
And before you give the microphone back, you better very quickly tell us what your four steps are.
Mm. Ah, that's giving it away, isn't it?
No, that was my question, so go for it. I'm just going to write this down. Hang on.
Very simply, knowing where you are today, your elevator pitch, knowing what your goals are, and then what the steps are to get to those goals, which are the next two steps in the middle, which I'll tell you about in person.
Good pitch. Let's start, I think, with the client hat on this time. Andy, what impresses you?
Oh, I thought you were definitely going to go somewhere else with that. I suppose the biggest thing for me, and this has been saying for all the team, is when you're picking an agency, whatever they're doing, is you know that you've got to work out what the value is for the agency. And obviously the agency likes to win awards and likes to get profile from what you do. But can you find an agency that genuinely is excited about the prospect of what you could achieve? And so I really like agencies that, and they're all doing, most of them are doing it for free, so you have to be careful. But I love the agencies that are really excited by the outcome, and I love agencies who win awards because of the outcome, not necessarily because of the creative. So that's probably my...
Simone?
That's a good question. The main reason why we've won most of the business we've won in the last 18 months, I would say, is based on relationships. I would say it's been our number one. Whether the relationships that we've built up from scratch or whether they've been relationships that we've nurtured, and I think what comes with a good relationship is trust. I mean, there's often times where you can present an idea that maybe isn't the best idea, but if the client works collaboratively with you, you can change the idea together. And rather than a sort of transactional, here's a brief, come back with an idea. So I would say winning new business for me has been about building relationships and building trust.
Stuart?
I'd agree with Simone. Actually, I wrote one word down, which was trust. Yeah. I think you've got to earn a client's trust, even at a pitch level, by not over-promising, by not making a whole heap of crap up that you really aren't sure you can deliver or that won't necessarily deliver results. So build their trust as early as you possibly can. And unlike most advertising agencies, we work on a slightly different model, which is about retaining business, not going and getting business. Everyone knows you make no money out of a client for your first year or two. We like to build long-term relationships with clients as long as possible. We've got 10-year clients, that sort of stuff. I'm sure these guys do as well. That's all about trust. They can say that bit of work, we rely upon you, you're as much a part of our business as anyone else. And when you get to that point, that's when you start smoking as an agency, because you can work, all your ideas are getting much less resisted as well. So build their trust as quick as you possibly can. That's not often easy in a 45-minute pitch to four marketing managers.
James.
It's an interesting question for me to answer, because I've been here at Mindshare 10 weeks and I lost a piece of business in my first week. So, I mean, just on that note, the whole sort of notion of trust is really important. I think in media agency world, it's an interesting point, considering I think we lost that business because someone made a ridiculous proposition as far as price is concerned. And I think that probably sort of differentiates pitching in media agency world, given the sums of money that are at stake, and some clients might find that quite attractive. I guess you have to ask, how on earth does someone make money if they're not charging anything for it? Someone's making a leap of faith there. But I think generally, as far as new business is concerned, I've always felt that new business starts at home. for two reasons. One, I think the average agency turnover of clients is about 10-15%. So if you're an average agency, then you've got to go and win 15% new billings just to stand still. So not losing those existing clients seems to be a good start point. As a consequence of that, you can start to build great relationships, do great work, build that level of trust with your clients. And then you start building advocacy as well, because people will start hearing about the great work you're doing. And again, certainly in media agency land, most clients, when they pitch, will go and talk to media owners. And media owners have a very clear, strong point of view about who's doing good work and who's strong out there and who's trustworthy. So looking after existing clients, doing great work, is undoubtedly one of the most important things to do. And certainly, I think that was, in my previous experience with OMD, that was the best thing to do. Get some great people, have a point of view, get them working well together, do some great work with clients, and then it goes from there. And then once you build that head of steam, you get on pitch lists just because people know of you and people know that you're doing a good job.
Greg Graham from Group M for the next question. If we can get the microphone to Greg.
Simple question. What's the work you're doing at the moment that you're most proud of and why? So a single example.
Let's start with Stuart.
Start with me. Unquestionably, we're doing some work with a group called Oz Harvest. Ronnie Kahn, we've been doing for 2 years. She came to us. She had a great idea, which was basically to rescue food, to rescue as much leftover food as you possibly can, and to get it to the homeless. And we started working with her probably 2 years ago. She won the Australian of the Year Local Hero this year. Her profile, we've been probably speaking every day for I don't know how long about interviews, building the profile, and she's that perfect combination of an absolute dynamo. She's got a great story to tell. She's got a wonderful idea that we're helping her execute, and watching its success and watching the joy that it gives her, the people around her, and all of our staff as we watch it happen. Chris Cuff, the other morning, I was sitting in listening to him talking about breakfast, and he said, I wanted to go from going from success to significance in his career. And I think that's one thing that all of us, that I'm starting to think of now. I think I'm getting older and I've got kids and all that sort of stuff. How do I go from running a moderately successful business to running something that's a bit more significant? And she's given me a whole lot to think about. Great woman. OzHarvest.org.au.
James Greet, what are you proud of at the moment?
You have actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Gone off.
Very worth it.
Well, exactly, yeah. You've which is very unlike you, isn't it? I think that's why everyone's gobsmacked, thinking what they're going to say. Sadly, I don't have anything as righteous as that. I don't think, or anything as philanthropic as that. Look. The work that I've seen our guys do, certainly when we reviewed all the sort of best work that we'd done for the MFA awards, and there's some really, really terrific work on there. And I think I was just really impressed with, A, the level and depth of the thinking, but also the fact that there was a very, very clear focus not on just doing media and measuring our success on how well we'd done media, but importantly, the influence and impact that it had on a client's business. And I think the thing that I'm perhaps most excited about is the position of the business around really understanding and making a move in data, because that's a real, real step forward for us as an industry. The thing I am actually most proud of is, having sort of spent a fair bit of time just talking to people and getting insight into where we stand as a business is just the passion that everyone has within our company, and the fervour with which they've sort of taken to, right, how do we sort of take mindshare and build it into a company that everyone wants to be part of. So I'm actually very proud of the people that work for us. Hope that doesn't sound too naff.
Simon, we'll come on to you.
I'm going to go back to the Telstra example, and it's not just because I've got my client here with me.
You also have McDonald's here, aren't
I
you?
I do have McDonald's here as well. I won't make the film left out. Well, the reason why I'm so proud of the recent work we've done on Telstra Youth is because it was a really great example of integrated, I know it's a bit of a buzzword, but we got such a great team of mixed disciplines together. So from traditional above the line, digital, creative, PR, experiential. And we also had a very brave client team that were willing to take a brand that young people think is for their mum and dads and put it into a very different type of marketing channels than Telstra are used to. And it took probably about 4 months to sell the concept into the client for them to let go of their traditional marketing channels. And we're now about 7 months into the campaign, and we've shifted brand consideration in just 7 months. So we know it's working, and it was a combination of a really bright team with a very brave client as well.
Andy.
Well, I've got two real quick, but the first one is we just finished doing a new sort of promotional 3-minute DVD with Village Roadshow and Animal Logic, and the tune's by Temper Trap. So have a look at that on YouTube, Earth Hour YouTube. It's fantastic. I really like it. And but the second thing, the thing that's kind of confusing me but is also really exciting is working on our mobile strategy for Earth Hour for the next 3 years. I think this year the mobile's gone over 5 billion users now, and by 2012 it'll be 6 billion. And if social media was the engine room this year, I think mobile will be, in conjunction with that, the engine room for the future. And it's amazing to see what we could do just by outreach, how far you can reach with mobile and where we could go with it. So they're the two biggies for me.
OK, let's take the next question. The Reading Room's Kathy McGinn.
If you'd been running the election advertising campaign for one of the parties, what would you have done differently?
More tough one. Let's start with Andy this time.
Oh, where do you start? The most obvious from Earth Hour perspective is both parties completely ignored climate change. And massive swing to the Greens. Either of the two parties who hadn't done that would have probably won the election. And so that's one part. The second thing is that was an incredibly dull campaign, and with a complete lack of credibility around so much of what was put out there. So I think putting out a more credible message, a clearer message, and better spokespeople would have been helpful. But you know. Here we go. Maybe it's a good result in the end.
Simone.
Yeah, it's a tough one. The obvious one is that I think the lack of engagement, really. They use very traditional channels. I'm not a big consumer of traditional media, and it didn't really reach and engage me. So imagine anyone sort of my age and younger. And there's some really great examples from around the globe of how political parties have really engaged. The obvious example is, you know, things like the Great Schlep for Obama. And they didn't really use any of those things to engage people. And I think, yeah, you're right, the result has shown that.
Stuart.
Well, I don't know much about advertising, so I'll start with that. But I would have, from a communication perspective, they treated the electorate like we were dickheads, that we were stupid. I would have got rid of the bullshit slogans, the cliches, an incredibly annoying repetition of sloganism, and I would have put some content into it. You know, a mate here asked about content. There wasn't any content in any of their... on either side. And I agree, you know, you had someone, rightly or wrongly, you know, on the left side, the Greens, who was a politician of conviction. You know, no one believed any of the shit that was going on in that election campaign. I thought it was an absolute abject disgrace. And I hope, you know, I'm one of the very few people in business who thinks having a few of these independents in the lower house is a bloody good thing, because it might make the two incumbent parties wake up to the fact that there might be a third force rising, and the Greens are another one of those third force, because I reckon anyone who had anything to do with either of the campaigns should be at Centrelink Monday. Hope there's no one from government here, because I've just stuffed that.
I'm going to vote for you next time. I think, Tim, judging by your shoes, you're obviously at Centrelink these days.
I'm loyal to the Converse brand until they fall apart.
Very good, very good. I think it's a very interesting question, because I think the whole sort of nub of the matter is that it's... doesn't matter how sexy or smart your advertising is or your marketing is, if you're trying to sell shit, then you can't. And there were two main reasons why I think it was absolute crap. One, they didn't stand for anything, okay? So it just became day-to-day horse trading. There was no vision or conviction behind, I guess, the big issues that this country is facing. And the Sydney Morning Herald actually ran a really interesting front page, I think, four Saturdays ago, and it said, what would this election be like if it was about things that mattered? And it had, like, five key things that really do matter to us, you know, whether it's water, infrastructure, etc., jobs. And no one had a point of view about the future of this country and how we were going to get there, given where we'd come from. So, one, there was no vision behind it. And two, you didn't even have a strong, compelling personality to actually drive it. Look, and I think on the back of what we'd seen in politics globally over the last 3 years, you know, we'd seen Obama, great strong personality with a vision and a conviction, and then you can sort of make great marketing, sort of bring it to life. I think it kind of made what we lack this time even more obvious because of its total lack of proof. So, you know, I don't think there's a lot you could have done. I was listening to a commentator on Sunday, and he said, look, actually, it should have been an election between Rudd and Turnbull. And Turnbull would have probably won, but at least you would have had two leaders who had a point of view and they would have been convincing in the way they delivered it. And obviously this election sadly missed both.
Let's focus on one of the few points of difference. A question from Matt Bateman from Viva 9. Where are you, Matt? Matt, are you here? Let me read out Matt's question for him then. Do you all agree that the NBN is absolutely crucial in helping build Australia into an even more clever country? It's a national broadband network. Stuart?
Yes, but I wouldn't like to rely on the Labor Party to instigate it.
James Greet?
Oh, look, I think something that absolutely supports and provides the infrastructure for our future, our technology future, is absolutely essential. That was interesting. I saw stats, it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago, that attempted to portray Australia or Australian media as highly innovative and technologically advanced. And it said something about we have the highest take-up of broadband in this country. I mean, we were coming from virtually zero. But if you actually looked at the infrastructure that supported it, I mean, Europe, particularly markets like Sweden and Norway, the Scando markets have broadband speeds that are 13 times faster than Australia. That's bound to have an impact on not just our industry, but how we do business and how we actually sort of do business with the rest of the world as well. So, yes, so we need it. The question is, do we actually sort of believe that the people in power, whoever's going to be in power, can actually get it up and running effectively?
Sim?
Yeah, agree, absolutely. Interestingly, when I was at Cannes, some of the best work was coming out of countries like Sweden, who definitely their uptake and engagement in social media, digital campaigns, you could feel is way ahead of us, and I think probably their broadband speed has got something to do with that.
Andy?
I'm not a tech head, Kerry, but yeah, of course, it's essential, but the big point is that the best way to deliver it, and do you trust that a government that hasn't got a brilliant record on delivering massive infrastructure projects to deliver something on budget, on time, and with the best outcome? Probably not.
Next question, Miguel Gonzalez, Encore magazine, over there.
Hi, good morning. Just a quick question. What's your current favourite TV commercial and why?
And I'll allow you to widen it if you want to beyond the TV as well. But your favourite ad and why? Maybe start with Andy this time.
Really good question. I have to say, the one that comes straight into my mind was the one that wasn't allowed to be used that appeared on the Gruen transfer, which was done by Republic of Everyone for the Green Party, not because it was green. I just thought it was what a brilliant advert in a, and what a shame it wasn't. They weren't able to use it because, in comparison to everything else that was on TV for the last month, that would have shone through.
And for those that haven't seen it, maybe you can just briefly describe it.
Yeah, basically, and I think Greens sometimes have some issues with this. It really just captured, I think it was the three key areas where they differentiated from basically the two main parties. So it was climate, it was boats, and I think it was the economy. I think it was the third one, I can't actually remember. But just really simple, really well done, and not preachy, which I really liked.
Sim?
My favourite one at the moment that I just think is really cute is the new Smarties campaign. I can't remember who it's by, you will remember.
I think it's JWT.
And what they've done is they've got little kids together with artists, like this little boy with a guitarist, and they've got to brainstorm. The artist has got to use the kid as inspiration for the brainstorm. And so the kid's favourite Smarties are blue, and then they have a big brainstorm about blue, and then the artist writes a song about it, but it's all from the child's mind, and it's just the cutest thing. I'd be interested to see where it goes, actually, because it's only just come out, and where the sort of end result of all the things that they create go.
Stuart.
A tough question. Sorry. Might be a bit predictable, but I actually like Droga's VB ad. I really did like that. I thought it was probably the hardest brief for the most iconic brand that you would have, and changing the VB ad was, it's putting yourself up there. And I liked the ad. I thought it was clever and quirky. I liked it more than maybe some of the Carlton ads, both the ones that didn't make it and the ones that did eventually make
Again,
it.
Again, just so everyone's got the context, this is the one of everyone marching on.
Everyone marching, and they had multiple ways of using it. It was a big ad, and I really liked that ad, but I must admit, that's just because it popped into my head. I haven't really thought about it.
James, what popped into your head?
Because it's alcohol-related at all. There are two I really like. One is the James Bogues ad. And the other is the... the only problem is the branding is obviously not so hot.
It's worth, again, describing the James Bogues one for people.
The James Bogues ad is the context of the water's just better in Tasmania and it turns anything into magic. And the way it's executed, there's beautiful examples in there. The one I remember is the guy who's sitting on the side of the river and pushes his girlfriend in. I don't know why I remember that, but most blokes remember that, even though it's kind of like a nanosecond scene in the ad. But the concept, what I love about it is it's not just a TV ad. Someone's thought of a big idea and a big proposition for a brand, and that's a wonderful space that they can go and own. And what I'm really interested in seeing is how they sort of develop that and really own that space. And to that end as well, I also like Coffee Without the Coffee moment. I can't remember what the brand is, but... again, you know, sort of a bigger idea there.
I think it's Dare.
Dare, that's right, that's right. There are two ads and they are both fantastic. I mean, the script writing is brilliant. What's beautiful is the way they've been executed. They're both executed so well, whereas you look at something I saw the other night, I hope whoever does this isn't here, the Jacobs Creek ad, you know, one of those where they kind of have the faux, we're friends sitting around having a relaxed dinner party, laugh.
Who does the PR for Jacobs Creek, Stuart?
Not Liquid Ideas anymore. So if there's any wine brands out there, we're free.
Well, they need you now, mate.
No, we retired Jacobs Creek in May, so it's not me anymore. Might be you.
That was about the time the ad came out, wasn't it?
We don't do advertising, we're PR agency, see?
I seem to remember you were the one who PR'd that ad to me, though.
Okay, Tim, moving on. Next question.
Let's take a question from Erica Valenti from Mango, please. Somewhere over there.
Thank you. What should Australian agencies be learning from the US and the UK when it comes to creative projects? And are we really that far behind?
I'll probably come to Sim last on this one because you've had the recent international perspective. So maybe start with James on that one.
All right. Okay. When I first came to, and I am actually now Australian, I voted on Saturday night, I have a passport, thank you very much. So there are two Australians sitting on the stage here. When I first came here 8 years ago, four. Wow.
What about you?
There we go.
I feel the odd one out. I'm the token Brit.
Maybe you should answer this question in that case then. When I first came here 8 years ago, and I think up until a few years ago, if you looked at the top 10 global creative directors, 5 out of 10 were Australian. There was this sort of big sort of thing that, you know, UK and America was where this good stuff happened, and that there was a sort of a lack of talent here. I mean, the reality was there wasn't. You know, Australia's a very sort of like smart, creative environment. All that was happening, I think, was that some of the best talent was then getting sort of picked up and taken overseas. I think the only big difference, therefore, is it's not about Are there a lack of people able to build ideas and bring ideas to market? It's more a question of whether or not people actually are prepared to sell them and people are prepared to buy them. I think you also have to remember as well that they're massive markets. So there is a lot of crap that happens, that's broadcast, that takes place in both of those markets. But by virtue of the fact there's just so much more going on, there is, as a consequence, pro rata, a lot more interesting stuff that goes out there. I think we just suffer from the fact that we're quite a small market, so sometimes it seems that there's not great creative work out there. I think, having said that, though, I think the standard of advertising is dire in this country. Absolutely dire. But there we go.
Stuart?
Oh, look, I profess I am absolutely not an expert in anything that's going on in the US and the UK. What has come to me quickly is that I really like the way GQ UK does everything, the way it talks intelligently to blokes, the way it integrates its brands, its partners, its sponsors, all of that sort of stuff. I like the way it uses its internet. I like the way it uses its social media space. And I like the way it owns everything that is intelligent and upmarket for men. I love the magazine. And I just think we could learn a lot about the future of talking to AB blokes from that, because we don't have that sort of communication in Australia, not just in an old-fashioned magazine. But I just think the way they throw their parties, the way they do everything is just brilliant. They are a really clever, clever brand that we could look at and learn some stuff from here.
And are you an international brand?
I think Australia's got a bit of a split personality, because there is plenty of creativity here. The work is brilliant, but maybe the market, there isn't the opportunity to use it. So we get the opportunity to use some brilliant stuff elsewhere that originates here. And that's not just in terms of creative work, but all aspects of the work that we work, whether it's mobile, whether it's any part that we're working on. The other thing I'd say is that some of the best work that we've seen doesn't originate out of the US or the UK, but rather out of places like Brazil or China, or we were just talking about this earlier on, Romania. There's some amazing work that just kind of knocks your socks off. I think this opportunity here is a big issue.
Sim, you've worked in more than one market and obviously seen some international work recently.
Yeah, I've seen
a
lot of really good international work recently in Cannes, and the most interesting work wasn't coming out of the US or the UK, even though the US did very well in the awards. Really creative work coming out of Brazil, completely different approach, ideas that probably wouldn't work here. But when you think how many people those campaigns are reaching in that country, other countries to watch were Sweden. Like we said earlier, you know, they've got great broadband, very great uptake of that. Japan, incredible work coming out of there. A lot of the smaller countries, New Zealand, some really great work coming out of New Zealand. And the work coming out from Australia stands up absolutely on the global stage. I think that we should be all very proud of the work that does come out of here, but I think, like we've said, there's great work and there's crap work coming out of most countries.
Stuart, did you want
Simone, are you talking in the context of PR or advertising? Or?
Both, yeah. I mean, I was very fortunate to judge the PR awards in Cannes, given that a lot of the entries were from creative agencies but had PR elements. I mean, these days, it was all so integrated, you know, there's social media PR, some above the line mixed in there. But yeah, one of the most incredible PR agencies I got a chance to talk to was out of Sweden, this incredible creative director. He was one of the brightest people I'd ever met. Yeah.
Can I just add a couple of points to that? I think one of the things that that does sort of like strike me about this market is that I think our median level or our average is by and large lower than other parts of the world. I think we are sort of quite happy here sometimes just to kind of accept something as okay, she'll be right, you know, just that'll be okay. I don't think we strive for the standards that maybe some other markets do. And I think, you know, maybe that's because we live in a very, very lovely place and there are better things to do than kill ourselves all the time working. And that's fine. But I think what that does do, though, is create the opportunity to be that much better, that much easier. I think probably one of the other things as well is, look, you know, our creative influence or field of creative influence isn't just kind of the rest of the industry.
but it's the media content that we consume. And I think, you know, we've probably sort of suffered with the fact that so much of our television is imported. In some cases here, that obviously stymies the opportunity for creative development locally and the development of sort of local creative industries and content industries. I think if you look at the standard of journalism by and large, compared to, shall we say, Britain, there is a very, very big difference in the quality of newspapers here and the journalism associated with those. I suppose the good news is that with the advent of the World Wide Web, we're not just having to rely on or be inspired by what's within grasp within the Australian borders. You know, suddenly we do get influence and access to great stuff coming out of Sweden because, you know, the wonderful thing is great ideas and stuff that makes us laugh or stuff that entertains us usually ends up in our inbox 24 hours after it's been published.
Just briefly before we move on, I think I have to go back to Stuart as a former soldier in Mr. Murdoch's army. How do you feel about that statement that the journalism isn't as good here?
Well, I deal with journalists in Australia every day, so one would want to be careful because these things... I said an indiscreet thing at a recent chat and I didn't realise there was a man videoing and it's up on the World Wide Web, this thing called YouTube. And yes, it's caused me unerring pain. I think you can have to say that the journalism standards in Australia do fall behind those, particularly in the UK and some of the outlets in the US. But it's outlet specific. It's a bit like saying that not all of us aspire to be great. You know, my business, we don't start any campaign aspiring to be anything other than the very best in the world, right? You know, we don't go out and say this is going to be the world's best campaign, but we settle for nothing short of doing absolutely everything we can to do the best. Now, journalism in Australia is tied to some degree by in a small market, which means there's no budgets, which means the journalists aren't being paid well enough, which means that a lot of talent is leaving and going to other areas. It doesn't necessarily happen that way, particularly in the UK, where you can earn a proper living being a columnist or a magazine editor or those sorts of things. So, you know, look, I don't think the media necessarily covered itself in glory at this election campaign either, for want of to reiterate that particular point.
Let's take the next question from Annabelle, Launch Group PR.
My question's about winning awards and whether you think it's important for agencies. Also, whether you have any tips on kind of creating award-winning campaigns.
So, does winning awards matter to agencies and what are your tips on how to win? Sim?
I think that winning awards is a different thing for PR agencies than it is for ad agencies. And I've just had a really great direct experience of that. So the PR award at Cannes is in its second year and probably 80% of the award entries were from ad agencies and not PR agencies. But they have a lot of vested interest. An ad agency can win you business based just on their awards. The creatives will get headhunted or get pay rises based on the awards. The executive creative director sort of global influence spreads because of things like Cannes. It's not quite like that for PR agencies right now. However, I do think that it's very important that as a PR industry, we support awards like Cannes, because if we want to be taken seriously by CMOs and PR beyond the table there, then we have to work in their space. So this year at Cannes, all of the biggest CMOs from around the world were there, so McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Unilever. But there was not really any great representation. Hill & Knowlton were there, Porto Novelli were there. So I think we have to do it to be taken seriously. As far as entering, our creative agency friends are very good at making videos. So we need to learn to make good videos, PR agencies, and that's another way that you win awards.
Andy, you've taken home metal from Cannes.
Yeah, I suppose come from a slightly different angle on this. I mean, and I was mentioning this earlier on, we're really happy when agencies win awards because it makes them happy and it definitely seems to motivate them. So that's good. And we actually, as a team, like winning awards because it's a good chance to get out on the razzle dazzle. But the one thing I'd say about winning awards, videos is clearly, and we're quite good at that. But the biggest thing for us is, and this before I worked on Earth Hour and WWF, I used to work when I was working in London. We used to have a lot of agencies who would do campaigns that were really about a one-off to win an award, And it drives me insane because it actually has, it's no value to an organisation if it's Prince's Trust or Earth Hour or whomever else, if there's a, you know, one billboard somewhere that might win an award but actually does bugger all for your campaign. So the biggest thing for me is outcome. And we're talking about how you pick an agency. If an agency wants to create the biggest campaign in history and it's really up for it and wins awards, brilliant. And they probably will win awards. So that's kind of, that'd be my take on it from an NGO perspective, I guess.
Stuart.
Well, as Mumbrella's PR, reigning PR agency of the year, I have to tell you that it's probably the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Including the birth of both children, getting married. Mate, I think the advertising agency's the greatest backslapping pack of knob jockeys of all time, if the truth be told. Their obsession with awards is breathtaking, to be perfectly honest. And look, it's nice to win. We are one from one at the moment. We have entered one award and won it, and I think I might retire at 100% of win rate. But look, honestly, it doesn't hurt. I agree. You know what? It's fantastic motivation for your staff. It draws attention to better candidates, I think, who might want to come and work with you because you're the agency of the year. Your clients go, you're nice. I think one thing that winning an award does is it shows you which clients really love you and value you. Some clients are pumped and send you bottles of champagne and beers, and others call you, 15 minutes after the award saying, "Have you finished that press release yet?" And you go, "You're a wanker. Can't we go out on the razzle dazzle for at least..." We just drink beer and wine in our office, but I think it's better to win them than not to win them. But I just don't reckon. I don't actually think it's gained us more work from current clients or new clients. We've still got to impress them in the pitch and be real.
James,
sure you're not going to expect me to follow that, are you? Can you ask me the question first and then he can do his joke a bit? Look, I think you've got to be in it to win it. So if you do actually sort of have the ability to go up there and get shortlisted and win stuff, then it means you're doing good work. And the fact that it then gets recognised and the individuals within the company get recognised, I think, is probably the best part of it. It's pure and simple.
Let's take a question, a non-pre-moderated question from the floor, if anyone wants to tell us who you are and where you're from.
Hello, it's Chris from PhD. David Jones, writing a few years ago in Contagious magazine, said that integrated communications are like weapons of mass destruction, in that everyone knows they exist, but no one's ever seen it done. Are different agencies integrating enough? And if not, what's your one bit of advice for getting more integration amongst agencies?
Oh, good question. James asked to go first, so there you go.
No, I didn't. I said before him. I guess there's two ways potentially of answering that question. One is, are agencies themselves integrated? And I think there probably aren't that many that actually are, because I think it starts by having a point of view about what's the right mix of solutions and how do they work together to help solve a client's business problem. And that needs some serious thought leadership. And I think a lot of agencies probably talk about it, but the bottom line is they lack the talent that can actually deliver that thinking. And then secondly, there's actually making it happen. And I suppose most clients are trying to find an integrated solution, but with a range of agencies. And the issue that most clients will say they have these days is trying to fit kittens into a sack, i.e. everyone wants to be the leader. By leading, they then want to put advertising or PR or the TV buy first or whatever. And therefore, you don't actually get integration because everyone's squabbling and fighting over it. So I think, the two big key things that clients probably want are great ideas and great thinking that is going to, I guess, solve their business problem. And then to have a group of people actually sort of work seamlessly together to make it happen. And I think sort of the politics of this industry, and in some cases the worst experience I've had are actually working with other fellow group members. I think in some experiences I've actually had better experience working with a random set of agencies that have nothing to do with our business, usually because they're actually sort of drawn together to do good work as opposed to they're a false fit in a marriage. And I think that's probably one of the biggest issues that clients have, which is how do I get my agencies to work together around one idea and make it happen, which is why you don't see it happen that often at the moment.
Stuart.
Mate, James, he's pretty much said absolutely everything I agree with. It's a great idea. It's wonderful in the ideal, but it's very, very difficult in the execution. It depends a great deal, I think, on the maturity of the people in the room who can actually set egos and their own need to drive to say, right, well, let's actually, you know, the whole idea of, I love the weapons of mass destruction thing. It's funny because if they can leave it aside and actually say, look, we will all come together for the betterment of the client. That's a very mature and intelligent way to approach it. Maturity, intelligence is occasionally missing at that particular table. But that said, we've had some excellent cross-agency relationships on some of our accounts, and it should be something the client really, really drives and almost forces us into, because sometimes I think the more we're forced into it, the more likely it is to become moderately successful.
Sim.
I agree with everything they've just said, and we're doing it successfully on some clients. I would also put it as well back onto the clients and how they're structured, because quite often we have successfully created an integrated model with a combined team. But then if we go back into the client and they're very siloed, then that creates problems if we're presenting back a very integrated idea to somebody that has only traditionally managed the TVC part of the marketing mix or the PR part. So it's kind of like the agencies and the client teams need to grow together.
Andy, your perspective.
Yeah, I think the client bit is probably the most important part. If the client is siloed, then how the hell do you expect all the agencies to work, or even one agency to work in an unsiloed way? And I think the first year we did, we were planning Earthbound just in Sydney, having Fairfax and Leo Burnett and WWF as partners as opposed to client, and we were forced into a situation where we had to work together at an equal level and integrate, and it became motivational, and it built momentum. And so client is everything, I think, in that relationship, and the agencies will follow.
Okay, next question. Let's go to Peter McDonald from Agency Register, who's sitting over there, if we can get the microphone. I think Peter holds the record for asking a question at every single question time so far. I try.
I'm sorry.
We're very grateful.
At a conference I attended last week, Justin Milne, obviously ex-Big Pond, Telstra Media, whatever, said brands are being built and destroyed online without companies being aware. Do you agree? And more particularly, what specific examples can you give?
Maybe start with Andy for that one.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure I know what that means, actually. But
Well, you see campaigns that flare up and look exciting, Old Spice and stuff like that. I'm really talking about building the brand, not just having a campaign that gets spread through the web.
I look for again, own experience. Big danger for us, I suppose, is the flare, and then it dies, people jumping on bandwagon, and then a campaign or an issue dying. I suppose that's all the same thing. But and I think the risk that we look at with that is unless you empower and engage your audience, it's almost back again to the first question. People have to have ownership of an issue or a campaign for it to live and breathe and go on beyond one commercial or 1 hour or one day. So I guess that is a big risk. But
Sim?
Interestingly, I think some of this answer links back to the first question about who leads social media and online, because one element that we're finding is businesses really needing to invest in monitoring what's happening online. And part of it is just back to good old traditional crisis and issues management, which PR people have been doing for years, monitoring the press and what people are saying about you. But I think, you know, basically people will be saying good and bad things about your company and have been for years. I see it as an opportunity because now we can actually really dig deep and hear what people are saying about a brand or a product. But it is an investment, and it's quite a significant investment, and it's on a daily and hourly basis. And then once you have all that data, then making the decision of what to do with it, because it's not something you necessarily have to react to.
Stuart.
Mate, I reckon Sim's answer is absolutely perfect. I honestly don't think I've got anything to add to that.
James.
Excuse me. I totally agree with what Justin said. I suppose the bottom line is that because you've got this very public two-way street, You know, it's not like 10 years ago where you spent a lot of money on advertising and said, look, aren't we wonderful, everything's great. And then the actual consumer experience of that product just stayed within that member's family if it was absolutely rubbish. The bottom line now is that you can go and push stuff out there and say things are wonderful and get people excited about them. But now if someone has a bad experience, then they can push it back the other way. You know, it's whether your brand or whether your personality, your reputation is at stake every day based upon how you behave. Because if someone had gone and checked, shall we say, a Telstra or Big Pond word cloud the day after I had my experience at a Telstra store 2 weeks ago, it would have been pretty unsavoury. The reputation would have been damaged, which is quite ironic considering it was Justin who was saying that. You know, and my advice there would be, in a world, therefore, where it's really easy for the public and the customer to share their experiences about you, then maybe you should think more and more and more about actually making the product experience as good as you say it's going to be. So there's no point in Telstra spending $150 million on advertising a year when I turn up and the shop is closed for an hour and a half. The bloke doesn't know what he's selling. He then eventually contradicts what he said the other day. And the store manager then doesn't turn an hour and a half late because he's been on the piss the night before. So I think that's, you know, it's very easy to see how reputations are built, but also how they're destroyed, which I think increasingly kind of means that people are actually going to focus on the legitimacy of the product and the experience and what it is they're actually selling, which is
no bad
thing.
It'd be interesting to see whether there's some word-of-mouth follow-up to your word-of-mouth thing.
It's like micro-issues management. We've been in issues management for a long time, so what I'm seeing is there's an extra degree of accountability for brands to make sure that they are delivering what they're promising through their advertising. And issues management for us from a PR perspective is something we're doing all the time. So there's two things I reckon. One is don't go... I've seen brands where there's been one comment, one very strong negative comment about a particular product online, and brand managers, I think for the first time, are getting that sort of feedback straight away, and they're going to this apoplectic fit about the crisis mode. So it's one person, probably an outlier, having a crack at your brand. Relax, you know, there's a big audience out there. So I think from us, there's often some micro issues management that's new to our world that I think we're going to have to do more of going forward to protect these brands, and also to let people know that by giving everyone this opportunity, you know, on the web to voice opinions, you know, everyone's got a blog and an opinion now, we can't react to all of them.
But it is extraordinary how one comment like that can suddenly bring everyone in, like, yeah. You know what I mean? And everyone's been thinking it, no one's been saying it. And we saw this on our Facebook site over the BP oil crisis. Yes. And there's nothing to do with climate or anything in that. It just turned totally into BP and why people were pissed with BP. And so, yeah, one trigger, though.
Let's take another question. Martin Lane of TNT Magazine.
Well, my question is, seeing as there are apparently a few here today, what makes for a good media recruitment agency?
We'll probably go to you last for that one, I think, James. Let's start with Stuart. What makes a good and a bad recruitment agency, and tell us about your experiences?
I'm recruiting at the moment, so I'm probably not the bloke to ask. One, it doesn't bug me with ridiculous CVs that I've got no interest in, and one of them has been doing that for the last 6 weeks, and I wish they would go away and never speak or ring me again. Thank you to them. I won't tell you who they are, but I'm sure they're not in this room because they're not bright enough to be here. Someone who genuinely, rather than just understands your business and understands what you're looking for and gets a sense of your culture. You know, it would be perfectly obvious after the last hour that we're an odd business. Right, a strange joint to work. So I don't want your straighty 180s coming and applying to work for me.
Sim, do you use recruitment agencies?
I do. I mirror everything that Stuart said. Just send us the right people. Don't send us people that need to go and work at, you know, a big corporate agency that's not like mine. Yeah.
Andy?
We do. We don't really use them, to be honest with you, Tim. It's all word of mouth, and that's how we recruit.
James, you're equipped to speak from both sides of this particular debate.
Okay, thank you. I think it's really simple. It's like any service industry or service business. It's about kind of understanding your client's business, what makes them tick, and also understanding your product as well. And I think probably the reason why a lot of individuals within recruitment industry aren't as successful as they could be is simply because they lack that real insight, knowledge and understanding. And if you lack that, then you're not actually helping a client progress his business. You're not helping an individual progress their career. You're simply just trying to match bits of paper with email addresses. And I kind of don't think you can really sort of put much value into that as a service offering. So I think that's the issue.
Let's take a question from Oliver from Tiger Spy.
Question relating to mobile, which was touched on earlier that Andy mentioned. How does mobile fit into your thinking around PR, brand building and customer engagement?
Let's maybe start with James for that one.
I think it's all of the above and more. I was in China about 6 weeks ago. And we were at a conference, and we had a couple of guys, local entrepreneurs, who ran various sites there, including mobile propositions. And I think one of the figures or statistics they mentioned was quite phenomenal. It's something like 400 million, a third of China's population, 400 million people have mobiles, of which 250 million of those are web-enabled. That's phenomenal. That's, you know, that's what 15 times the size of Australia actually have web-enabled mobiles. I mean, in that respect, in a market like China, mobile is the new video broadcast or broadcast video. I mean, there's a reason why the Chinese government will do that, and that's because it makes it easy for them to control and influence what that population thinks. I think we're probably a little bit more democratic here. But I think the really interesting thing is if you actually look at what Facebook have just launched in UK or Europe. So they've got, what, 500 million users worldwide, and they've just launched their location-based proposition. Now, what that means for retailers, for example, in terms of understanding who's doing what, when, where and how, and the data that they could learn and get access to on that, is absolutely phenomenal. And I think whether it's mobile or any form of technology, it's less about what it means as a medium, it's more about the data that it's going to give us access to and the learning it's going to give us to actually make what we do for our clients so much more relevant, focused, targeted and business relevant.
Stuart, do you want to add anything?
No, I don't have much to add to James, to be honest. I know how important it's going to be. I just haven't... I'm a bit of a laggard there. I'm a bit slow. So I'll be... Ask me in 2 years.
Sim?
We've just recently, another Telstra campaign, I do work on other things apart from Telstra, but we just recently did a youth project that was partly based here and partly in Japan, where the actual handset was at the heart of the campaign, be it SMS, web portals, using augmented reality. It was for a youth audience, but it was a really good example where that sort of led all of the other activations from the mobile. So they are definitely very important.
Andy?
Yeah, well, mobile's everything for us. I was saying earlier on that it's about 5 billion, some of the numbers down here, 5 billion subscriptions at the moment, 6 billion within a couple of years. And if you look at the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, India, China and South Africa, that's 75% of the world's population, 2 billion users in those countries. So 60% of those are using SMS. And here's an interesting stat from the States, recently got the other week, which is in 2008, $800,000 was given by mobile to charity. Last year, 4 million. First 3 months of this year, 44 million. So for us, we see the mobile as bringing the planet into the hands of people. It's a tool to vote with. It's a tool to give with. It's a way of creating a 21st century NGO with transparency and cutting your administrative charges and your fundraising charges. So for us, it is everything. And I think it's by 2013, more than 50% of the world's population will be accessing the internet by their phones, not by PCs or laptops.
Well, guys, that is all we've got time for because we do try to get you out on time. Thank you very much for supporting the event again. Really appreciate it. Hope to see you at another one. In the meantime, please thank our panel, James, Stuart, Sim and Andy. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening to the Mumbrella Cast. You can read more at mumbrella.com.au. Back next week.
Toodle pip.